And yet, I'm sure that there was affection between the two of you, wasn't there?
I think was really very fond of me, and I was very fond of her. I think I was probably, at times, more resentful of some of the difficulties. She always felt that the children were her children, and she did, very often, things which completely undermined any possibility of discipline. For instance, we had given Franklin Jr. a small Ford car and erected on a dare to drive into a pole. And he came home very sad, and we told him he just couldn't have another car. He was college. We said, well, all right, you wrecked your car, well, you just won't have another. And he went away very silently, and he talked his grandmother. They either Frank nor Johnny could talk her into anything. And he talked his grandmother into giving him a LaSalle car. And 2 weeks later, he appeared with the LaSalle car. And I was furious. And he said, well, Granny gave it to me. I went to my husband and said, what are we going to do about this? And my husband rather indulgently smiled and said, I don't think we can do anything. Which was obvious. We couldn't do anything as far as the children were concerned. She did what she thought was right. I didn't think our second boy, Elliot, should go to Groton. But I had absolutely no choice. He went to Groton.
Well, what influence do you think this has had on your evaluation of your grandchildren?
Well, I think it's made me much more careful not to interfere. I never interfere with any of my grandchildren.
Do you think that you might have, if it hadn't been for the experience?
I don't know. I'm a very executive person, and I'm a person who manages things, and I might have.
Has it been a temptation for you at times?
No. No, I never have had the slightest temptation, because I've always felt so strongly that you should let people lead their own lives.
Well, as you say, her passing away was really the end of an era.
It was the end of an era. Nothing was ever quite the same again. We were just starting the war, you see. By December, we were in the war.
Mm-hmm.
And Frank never had any time, because he had too much to do.
Mm-hmm.
Frank never settled her estate. I settled both estates. I suggested to him that we do something different in the house, and he said no. Historically, it'll be more interesting the way it is. And we never changed a thing, and of course he died so soon. There never was any argument about it, because it was so obvious that when he died, of course, we turned it over to the government.
Yes. You talk about the president's way of doing things and about your own problems, and you said that in my early married years, the pattern of my life had been largely my mother-in-law's pattern. Later, it was the children and Franklin who made the pattern. When the last child went to boarding school, I began to want to do things on my own, to use my own mind and abilities for my own aims.
Yes, I began first by teaching.
And did you have a pretty clear idea as to what your aims were then, Mrs. Roosevelt?
No, I don't think I had. I took whatever came to hand to do.
Mm-hmm.
I'd gone into the Democratic State Committee, and I happened to have made a friend who wanted to take over a school. She asked me if I would join with her, and I did. And that was easy to do, you see. I never have planned anything as far as I was concerned. I've just done what came to hand.
Yes. I was amused by your comments about the fact that you learned from your husband that a good politician is marked to a great extent by a sense of timing. You went on to say that your husband always said that you were far too impatient ever to be a good politician.
Yes, he did.
But you also said that you've grown more patient with age.
Well, I've grown more patient with age. I don't think I'll ever be a good politician.
Well, according to this statement, I think that you have the ingredient here for a very acute politician when you say that you think your observations of conditions and of the feelings of the average people in our country are fairly trustworthy.
Yes, I think they are, fairly.
Even today?
Even today. Of course, I still do a great deal of traveling. And as long as I have a chance to go out and see people and see conditions in the country, I think they will be trustworthy. Now, whether they would be if I were judging entirely from what I read in newspapers, that I can't tell. Though I think I've learned to read newspapers and read widely enough to gauge fairly well what is happening in the country. But I feel much better when I can actually go and see for myself.
Well, don't you feel with that sensitivity and knowledge that you do become a potent political force in your own right? Your advice is certainly sought by the party, and I'm sure for that reason.
Yes, but not really in my own right. I know a great many people who, as they talk to me, I think, clarify their own thinking. I don't think they care very much what they get from me. I think it's more the chance to talk and think through what you think. I'm quite a good listener. After all, you must recognize that that's what I did for all the years my husband was alive.
You really did.
And so that it comes very naturally to me to listen to people and let them talk and give them an opportunity to think through for themselves.
Well, now, I can't quite agree that you've always merely listened. I know you've listened to a very great extent, but you've said this. Franklin might have been happier with a wife who was completely uncritical.
Well, I was critical, but I never did it unsolicited. I mean, if he wanted to discuss something, I never told him just what I thought he wanted to hear. I told him what I honestly thought and what I honestly thought the ordinary person that I was trying to represent felt. And I was not what you would call a yes man, because that wasn't what he needed.
But was that what he wanted?
I don't think it was what he wanted. I think, however, that there were times, and particularly towards the end when he found argument very difficult. And even in the earlier days, he might have been happier if he had always been perfectly sure that I would have agreed. He wasn't. And it was probably good for him that he wasn't. But there must have been times when he would have liked it if he didn't have to argue things.
Mm-hmm. Well, you also said that sometimes you acted as a spur, even though the spurring was not always wanted or welcome.
Yes, I think I did very often, because I had this horrible sense of obligation, which was bred in me. I couldn't help it. It was nothing to be proud of. It was just something I couldn't help.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes Franklin had had, in a way, an easier life than I had, and he hadn't had many difficulties. And sometimes he would like to do the easier thing, even though he wasn't pretty well convinced that that wasn't the right thing to do. And I think those were the times when he wished goodness he didn't have to look at someone who would demand of him what he really thought was the thing he ought to do. In a way, my conscience bothered him. And that's a perfectly natural thing. He was a very human person in a great many ways.
I thought that the other statement that you made was very significant, and I'd like to discuss it with you. You said that you were one of those who had served his purpose.
I did serve his purpose, because he needed a great many different kinds of things, and he got them from a great many different kinds of people. But I was one of the people who did serve his purpose in the first place. He got from me the point of view of people, the average person in the street, very often. When he wanted something, he could get me to do it. It was his idea that I should go abroad during the war and take the trips that I took. Now, he knew I wanted to do it, would be glad to do anything that could be useful, but nevertheless, it was his idea, not mine. I would never have dared suggest it. And I think that no one person could ever have met all of Franklin's requirements, but I met certain requirements that were indispensable. You see, from a very early period, Franklin became a public man. You have to remember that.
Yes.
You have to remember that from the time he went into the Senate, he was really always a public man and always going on to something else.
You were married in 1908, weren't you?
I was engaged in 1903. I was married in 1905.
So that at least you had 5 years of non-public life in your marriage.
But most of the time, he had, part of his whole thinking was that he would have a political career.
Mm-hmm.
And I was part of that pattern. just as Louis Howe was part of the pattern,
yes, of
from
course.
The time he came into his life. And I think that I served the pattern of what he planned as a life. And I was indispensable in many ways. But you can't say for a man who was as many-sided as Franken that any one person could have covered everything he needed. You couldn't do it.
About his advent into politics in 1910, so many people, Mrs. Roosevelt, feel that he was much more the social young gentleman who mixed well in society, who was handsome, who was well-mannered.
Well, that was true. Actually, I think, until the Navy Department days, it began then and was accentuated by the defeat for the vice presidency. Now, he went back into a business life, mm-hmm. and he did his job.
This was just before the infantile
this
paralysis.
This was after he ran for the vice presidency.
1920.
Before he got polio. And then polio on top of that meant time to think of a great many things that he probably might never have had time to think about. He actually grew spiritually, and I felt that the latent powers and abilities were all there. They would have developed perhaps in a little different way, but that developed them more quickly and more decisively than anything else would have.
Well, what I wanted to ask specifically is this. Do you feel that personally you became closer or not since he assumed the presidency?
Well, when a man becomes president, you have to decide how you are going to remain close. And the only way to do that, I really think, unless, well, I don't think this was probably necessary in Mr. Hoover's day, but I doubt it even then. But we had nothing but crises. We were always living in a crisis. And actually, you had to decide that either your interests were going to be the same, or you couldn't in any way share the life of the president, because he had to be engulfed by the things that were happening and which he had to deal with, and there was no time for him to do anything else. So either you became interested in those things and felt about them as he did and worked with them and worked to make his life easier, or you weren't going to have any touch at all.
And you chose to do that, of course.
Yes. Wasn't anything else to choose.
And in that sense, I think actually your life did become closer, didn't it?
Well, it has to.
Because of the dependence.
It can't be anything else. It's more impersonal in a way, because it's not your personal interests. It's the interests of the thing you are doing.
Yes.
And, of course, most men have, I think, a greater sense of history than women. I think men see things in an historical setting, and Franken, I always felt, was thinking of what this would mean in history in the future. And I'd be darned if I cared what it would mean in history in the future any more than I care today, do you see? But nevertheless, you had to look at it from that point of view.
Yes, of course. Well, from that point of view, it was easy for him, I think, then to realize what you realized much later and what most of us realized much later, that the New Deal, as he instituted it, was actually the sort of antibiotic for capitalism and for the system that we've had in this country.
If we were going to have capitalism, we had to have the New Deal.
Mrs. Roosevelt, you've said that the president often used you to get the reflection of other people's thinking, because he knew that you had made it a point to see and talk with a wide variety of people. Now, what I'd like to do is to call the roll of the names of some of these people who had served both you and Mr. Roosevelt, and see what mention of their name would recall to your memory. Let's begin with Edward J. Flynn, Boss Flynn of the Bronx.
Well, Ed Flynn, of course, I was very fond of. He was a boss, and he knew, of course, the shady side of politics. You couldn't very well be a boss of a county in New York and not know the shady side of politics. But personally, Ed Flynn had a very high standard of honesty and integrity. And he had the intelligence to understand what Franklin was really doing. And I think he backed him with understanding where others backed him out of loyalty and affection and self-interest, but without understanding. And that, I think, is one reason why there was never any break with Ed Flynn, because he always had an understanding of the objectives Franklin was trying to obtain.
Well, of course, that even holds, I'm sure, more so with Louis Howe.
Louis Howe was quite unique, because Louis Howe came in so early that there was a feeling there which was different from anybody else. He felt older. He felt like the advisor, and was the advisor, and never had the slightest sense of awe of Franklin or of having to say yes when he meant no. And so he was a very useful person, and he had one, being a newspaper man, he had one really very extraordinary faculty. He could tell what was going on in the world by sitting home reading the papers, and he did it. And often when I was going out on a trip, he would tell me what the feeling would be out in the places I was going to, and he was always right. And so his advice was very good always to Franklin, and Franklin really valued it and came to count on it. Of course, my secretary, Miss Thompson, was to both of us a very... See, she was with me 30 years.
Yes.
And he had as much a feeling that she was, well, the children all looked upon her as a second grandmother, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And she grew to be sort of part of the family for both Franklin and me.
Yes. How about James F. Burns?
Well, I think Franklin had a great admiration for certain brilliant qualities that Mr. Burns had. And I think he tried to use him because of an admiration for those qualities, and he did so very successfully, because Mr. Burns did very good work in certain ways. But I have often thought he must have had times when he realized there were weaknesses in Mr. Burns. But once my husband made up his mind to work with someone, he nearly always stuck to working with them and tried to find ways of meeting difficulties and not having breaks with people, which is illustrated by his whole relationship with Harold Ickes, who wanted to resign so often.
I was just coming to Harold
and
Ickes.
And always stayed, because somehow or other my husband always got around the difficulty. And it's really very funny as you look at it. And I think my husband was fond of all these people, many of whom differed with him very strongly. As Harold Ickes did, Jimmy Burns did at times. But I think Franklin, whoever he worked with, he got fond of them, and he hated to have anything come between them. Of course, that was, I always thought, one of my husband's difficulties, that he hated so ever to be disagreeable to anyone whom he really liked. And that extended even to the people who did personal things for him. We always laughed, because there was a delightful coloured man called Mays who was on the door. And he always cut all the president's hair. And he always cut Franklin's. And time came several times for Mays to retire. And he would be told by the usher that he must retire on a certain day. And just before the day arrived, he would be cutting the president's hair. And he would say, "Oh, Mr. President, I'm afraid this is the last time I'll be cutting your hair." "Why, Mays, what do you mean?" my husband would say. "Well, they tell me I has to retire." And my husband would say, "Oh, no, Mays, no reason why you should retire." And then, against all the rules and regulations of retirement, Mays would get an extension, and this went on time after time. He never did retire until after Franklin was out of the White House. And he just found it almost impossible to be disagreeable to someone he liked and had worked with. If he got very angry and felt very deeply about it,
mm-hmm.
then he could just wipe a person off the face of the earth. But it had to be a very deep emotion. He didn't often get angry, but when he did, oh, man.
Well, of course, his whole administration during the 3.5 terms was bound to become controversial by the very nature of the men that he had brought into the government, men whose viewpoints were certainly conflicting, if not their personalities. I'm thinking right off the bat of Jimmy Burns and Harry Hopkins.
Well, you didn't ask me about Jim Farley.
I was saving Jim Farley till the very
end. Well, what I said about Ed Flynn would hold for Farley. Farley was absolutely devoted and loyal and a wonderful worker, but he did not understand what the objectives were, and it didn't matter to him, mm-hmm. because if the boss wanted it, that was enough, do you see? And whether he really believed in it or not didn't seem to affect him. But when a thing came up that he really didn't believe in, and where his own ambitions came into it, then, of course, it was a break, and a break which actually I don't think Jim Farley ever quite understood.
You're speaking about the third term.
Yes. And I've always been sorry about it, because I think he wonders now why I was annoyed with him. But he was, for many, many years, as loyal and as fine as a co-worker.
Yes.
But not because he understood the objectives. That was the difference between Flynn and Farley.
In spite of the fact that they both had primarily the same beginnings.
Yes.
I wanted to ask you specifically about a man I know that you admired a great deal, and that's John Wynant.
Wynant, of course, was... I think Franklin had the most tremendous admiration for John Wynant. He had a very deep affection for Harry Hopkins, and Harry Hopkins gave him something which he needed after Louis Howe died, which was absolute devotion.
Mm-hmm.
And he could count that Harry Hopkins would carry out whatever he wanted. But with John Wynant, I think he had a much deeper, real admiration for him as a person, sense of integrity there, and of accomplishment on his own, which went very deep. He had great admiration for John Wynant. He was an extraordinary human being.
Well, few people in all history have had a life in any way comparable to that of yours and your late husband's. But at this point in your life, Mrs. Roosevelt, with all that's gone before, I wonder what your aim is, as of now.
I don't think I have any particular aim any more than I've ever had. I will go on doing whatever comes to hand to do, and I would like to be busy. But I don't think I have any particular aim.
But your dedication to the UN through the American Association?
Well, I would like to see the UN succeed. I would like to see a more peaceful atmosphere grow in the world. I don't expect to see it in my time, but I would like to feel that as much as could be contributed to it, I had contributed. I like to see liberal causes succeed, because I think it's important, if we're going to stay a democracy, that they do succeed. But I don't have any specific aim. I've just done things as they came along to do too long in my life. I guess I would just go on until the end, just doing things that happened to come my way.